Welcome to Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here is the podcast host, James Dellingpole.
Welcome, friend, to the Dellingpole podcast brought to you by me, James Dellingpole, and our friends at Breitbart. I am so excited about the double guest special this week. They are my old friends, Phelim McAleer and Anne McElhenney. And I've known them for years, and when I first met them, they weren't nearly as famous as they are now. They were just a couple of struggling, jobbing filmmakers, just trying to make ends meet. And now they're megastars. They've got a New York Times number one best-selling book called Gosnell, about a guy that in England most people won't have heard of him, but it's a very, very good and sick story. So Phelim, tell us briefly about why people should rush out and buy your best-selling New York Times book.
Well, it's the untold story of America's most prolific serial killer, perhaps the world's most prolific serial killer, actually. He's killed hundreds, perhaps thousands, in a 30-year killing spree, and no one's ever heard of him. So if you like true crime, it's political, it's gory, it's moving, and it's written by us. Any other reasons they should go out and visit him?
Well, you should probably mention the fact that maybe the reason why no one's ever heard of him is because of exactly who it was that he murdered. So if he'd murdered, school children, we know about school children being murdered, and we get those a lot of information about those stories. What Gosnell did was he induced women to give birth, women who wanted to have abortions, that was their intention, and then the babies were born alive, and he cut the babies' necks with scissors, and he did this over a 30-year killing spree. This is what makes him newsworthy. This is what makes him the most prolific serial killer in America. What makes the story compelling and important to read?
Yeah, we want to make it clear, he's convicted. He's currently serving life without parole.
No danger of a lawsuit then.
No, but
I'm not a serial killer, actually. I'm just an innocent
Some people think he's a serial killer because he's abortionist. That may be true, but he's a convicted killer. He's in prison. We visited him in prison. We can confirm he's there. Yes, and he had a great time putting his hand on Anne's knee on about 30 separate occasions.
So it's kind of interesting, obviously Phelim and I have spent a lifetime watching bad television, like a lot of your listeners possibly, and we particularly like anything crime-related. And obviously in all the crime shows, as everyone knows, there's a plexiglass, you got the telephone, not where Kermit Gosnell's in prison, in Huntington, in Pennsylvania.
There's more security in this green room.
There's more security in
this green room we're in now. It's like a rec room at a, in a school or whatever, or low coffee tables or whatever. He comes in, he's able to move the cherries on, and I'm sitting with my legs together, and I'm backed up against a wall. He comes and brings himself right into my personal space, puts his legs on both sides of mine, and then every now and again, I'm going to do it now to James, which James is enjoying. I'm not touching James much.
No, I'm getting a cold, clammy feeling and a sort of shiver down my spine, because you've transferred the spirit of Kermit Gosnell.
There you go. So he keeps touching my leg to emphasize a point and then apologizing. And in a particularly sick moment, here's a guy who, it is extraordinary what he did. The descriptions of the deaths of the babies is really the stuff of nightmares. And so you're interviewing this guy who has the affect that he's just played golf. He's incredibly charming, smiling, has this mellifluous voice. And then he says, a friend of mine, the guy who composed the music for the movie, Boris Elkin, Boris had said to me, ask him about music, because people's music choices can be very interesting and very telling about them. So I start talking to him about music, and he starts saying, it's been great just now that I have more time to myself. So he's almost treating being in prison like it's kind of like a holiday camp or whatever, and he suddenly had this wonderful, liberty. And so he says, but I've been listening, it's interesting. I've discovered Jacques Brel, And of course, you and I, James, know Jacques Brel, the Belgian crooner who smoked himself to death in his 30s. And Gosnell did this occasionally during the interview. He'd do this brain freeze thing. He'd go, "What's the name? What's the name of the famous Jacques Brel song?" So I'm sitting there thinking, do I help him? Do I tell him? And then I thought, I do. I tell him. So I say, "Ne me quitte pas." And he goes, leans right into my face and goes, "Ne me quitte pas," and starts singing "Don't Leave Me" in French to my face. You know, don't leave me. We must not forget what it, you know, whatever the words are. You know, that's enough.
Yeah,
yeah. So you know, this was kind of
if you go away, it was the Scott Walker version.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. There you go.
Did you talk about Scott Walker with Kermit Gosnell?
Yeah. So, So he's in prison. He's America's biggest serial killer. We've written a book about the investigation and trial of Kermit Gosnell and the lack of investigation of Kermit Gosnell, how he was allowed to kill for 30 years because even though he ran a house of horrors, it was never inspected by the local authorities. They were closing nail salons. They were closing restaurants for having dirty kitchens. He ran an abortion clinic where bodies were literally piling up in the cellar. 47 bodies were found, but it was hands-off abortion clinics.
Also, like the details of how he, of this clinic. So there were cats walking around in the procedure rooms. He would eat cornflakes in the procedure rooms where he was doing these abortions, quasi abortions. They weren't really abortions, as I said. He was delivering the babies alive because it was cheaper. He wasn't an OBGYN, so he filled women up with this thing called Cytotec, which induced them to give birth. And the descriptions of the babies squirming alive, crying, one of them swimming in a toilet, are absolutely the stuff of horror movies.
No.
Yeah. No, these babies were alive. Baby boy A and baby boy B. They were alive. They struggled. Some of the staff played with them, grabbed their hand, and the hand was.
No.
Yes. Yeah. And then he came along with the scissors.
Oh, how. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm lost for words here. That is so horrible. So, what was. I mean, not that you necessarily know, but what was his motivation?
Money. One of the things was he's a serial killer. He's very, very greedy. He made a lot of money. I mean, when the cops eventually caught up with him and raided his home, there was $250,000 in cash in his daughter's bedroom. The descriptions. I want to just read a little short piece here about the death of baby boy A. According to one of the witnesses, Cross. Abrams is the mother of the baby. Abrams was heavily sedated when she was taken into the procedure room, and the baby just came out. Gosnell was in the room. The baby was about 18 inches long. Gosnell put the baby in a Tupperware container. He was still breathing. Gosnell did not cut the baby's neck straight away. He was so big that his arms and legs hung over the sides of the container. Cross testified about what happened next. So here's what she said in under oath. He put it in a shoebox, and the baby was hanging over the shoebox, but the baby somehow, some way came together, she said. Pescatore, the assistant district attorney, asked Cross to show the court what the baby did. The baby just came together in the picture. It shows that the baby was just in the shoebox like this. Judge Meinhardt was not quite following. When you say came together, he interjected. What do you mean? Because when Dr. Gosnell put the baby in the shoebox, the baby was hanging over the shoebox. Pescatore asked Cross to stand up in the courtroom and show how baby boy Abrams curled up in the container. She crouched into a fetal position, and the jury were silenced and stunned.
Oh.
But he played with other ones. They grabbed their hands. And then, was that the baby where he said, this one's big enough to walk me to the bus stop?
He made a joke about it.
And then he killed it.
So he was obviously really getting off on this.
Yes. Yeah. Stuff. I mean.
And by the way, yeah. And when you say that, actually, I mean, one of the other disturbing finds when they eventually caught up with him was they opened up, like a kitchen cabinet where there was peanut butter and Jello and people keeping the stuff for lunch, and they found row upon row upon row of jars with baby's feet that had been severed that he had kept. So he kept trophies, and they were labeled. And in one case, we know the cops caught up with there was 2 feet off the same baby that were in a jar. They got in touch with the woman whose name was on that, and that was indeed her baby that she had aborted, and she retrieved those feet. They've been buried. I mean, so these are the kind of stories that the book is crammed with.
I think we're giving away too much of the book here.
Yes, they were. Nobody's going to come.
No, they are.
You can buy the book at gosnellbook.com, and it's available on Audible, on ebook, and it's sold out on every platform the first week it came out.
Well done,
James. You're not supposed to say nobody's going to buy the book. You're supposed to
be shamelessly
promoting
the
book.
We're all among friends here. Uh-huh. It's going to be okay. I'm very, very impressed that you've done so well with this one. I'm not surprised. It sounds a great story. How did you find it?
Well, funny, I was happened to be in Philadelphia promoting Frack Nation, promoting our last documentary.
There were some very cool people in that film.
Yes. Yeah, actually, that's right. Yeah, there's
Some people need it. What do you call it? Subtitles, though? Posh people. Yeah.
Posh English
journalists. Who made the outrage? Do you remember that? Who made the outrageous suggestion that Russians might be interfering in?
That was the first film. I think I was one of the first journalists to say it, to make that claim.
Yes. Yes.
But it's absolutely true, isn't it?
No, it's been proven. Hillary Clinton said it in private. So you said it on our documentary, Frack Nation, that was 5 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton said it at a private gathering of bankers in Canada. One of the speeches came out. She said that the Russians were funding it. So, can I just say,
my relations with Vladimir have never been the same since.
Yeah.
I've had no more invitations back.
No more Kremlin gold.
No more Kremlin. Just I'm... It's been awful. So thanks.
Whatever the Russian is for persona non grata.
Yes.
Comrade. Yes. Where was I?
Go on, you're explaining.
I was promoting Frack Nation in Philadelphia, and as a journalist, when you're in a strange town, you lift the local paper and check what's going on. And I saw this rather strange court case, so I went down on my day off to the courtroom and went in and saw there was during the cross examination of one of the staff, and there was on the wall on a big screen was a picture of baby boy A, like horrific picture. The baby was so big all the staff took pictures of him with their phone, and then there was this enormous footage, awful footage, and that was the most shocking evidence I'd ever heard, the most shocking photograph I've ever seen. But behind me was even more shocking. The place was completely empty. No journalists at all, except for a couple of local journalists and grubby Macs, you know. And that became a story in itself, the way the national media refused to cover. It is the untold story of America's most prolific.
Why do you think the national media didn't cover the story?
Well, they explained it. Eventually they actually admit to it. So it was very interesting. So pro-life activists and conservatives started to get onto Twitter and started to ask, what's going on here? Why is this case not being covered? And one of them basically asked Sarah Cliff of the Washington Post, why are you not covering this? And Sarah Cliff famously said, oh, I don't cover local crime stories. She described this as a local crime story. These are the same people, by the way. These are the mainstream media who, you know, made Trayvon Martin a household name, made Michael Brown a household name. Michael Brown was a thug who assaulted an immigrant in a corner shop and then walked up the center of the street in Ferguson, Missouri, and tried to beat a cop to death and died for his trouble. But he's a hero, but no one's heard the people who died here. So two women died here. And by the way, they're central casting for the kind of people that the left, that progressive describe. So one woman, Samika Shaw, young African-American, 22-year-old, died after a botched abortion at Kermit Gosnell's clinic. Karnamaya Monger, a Bhutanese refugee who had spent 20 years in Nepal in a refugee camp, only to come to America, be here for 4 months, and die as a result of being drugged to death by the inexperienced workers at this clinic. And no one bothered. And those two women died there, and still the Department of Health did not inspect the clinic. And the reason for that is very disturbing for us conservatives. A lot of the reason goes down to a conservative, a Republican, Governor Tom Ridge, who not a conservative, I suppose, but Governor Tom Ridge, who was a Republican, who got in to Pennsylvania as governor on a pro-choice ticket, and who basically said to the Department of Health, hands off the abortion clinics. So for 17 years after he was elected, no one crossed the threshold to check out what was going on. And if they had, they'd have found the bodies piled up in the basement, they'd have found the severed feet in jars, they'd have seen the cats walking around, and a profound smell of urine, because the toilets were backed up with fecal remains, and people peed on the corridors.
So you think that one of the reasons this story didn't get circulation was because it was considered almost a conservative-friendly horror story?
Exactly. Look, they don't want to do...
The liberal media just thought...
Yeah, the liberal media don't want to do anything that casts a negative spotlight on abortion. And you can't read this without having... having your faith, and I mean that literally, because abortion is almost like a sacrament to the left. Without having their faith shattered in abortion or questioned, funny, the jury, the most shocking part for the jury of this trial was not the pictures of the babies, not the evidence. The only time they gasped was when a good abortionist gave evidence. So the prosecution wanted to distinguish between bad abortions and good abortions. This is murder. Just to make sure you understand, that's murder. This is a legally, constitutionally protected abortion. So they got this good abortionist in, and the first question he was asked was, how many abortions have you done? And he said, 40,000. And the jury went, what? What?
And we're just looking at you, James, and you're basically gasping there, and that's exactly what they did. They actually made noise. They made an audible gasp. And I suppose when you think about it, if 50 million babies have been aborted in the United States, somebody's doing it. Somebody has to be doing it.
Yes.
So he did 40,000, and that was his way of explaining that he actually was a very qualified person to speak to how legal abortions are performed.
Then he described how legal abortions are done, and it is horrific. Like, it is, you know, you pull out an arm or a leg and you inject the baby in the heart with the potassium chloride to kill it, and it's like you suck the brain and all this stuff, and the jury's just going, oh my god. And then Gosnell's defense lawyer says, well, what happens if a baby's born alive? Because he was sort of you know, this is part of his defense. And she's going, well that never happened. Well, if it did, well then we would give it comfort care, said the good abortionist. And the defense lawyer says, what's comfort care? Well, we would set it aside, put a blanket on it, keep it warm. Eventually it will pass, right?
Right.
And the jury's sitting there going, so we're convicting this guy of murder for stabbing a baby that's born alive, but you're allowed to put it aside and let it die of dehydration and neglect. And that's a constitutionally protected right. And it's like, so that was the most shocking part for them in many ways, was what's legal, not what the illegal. You expect horrific illegality, but you don't expect horrific constitutionally protected legality.
You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my special guests, Anne McElhenney and Felim McAleer. More in a moment.
Check out the official Breitbart store today. Store.breitbart.com is the home for the brand new official Breitbart store. Head there now for products for women and men, like t-shirts, baseball tees, tank tops, hoodies, and hats, or an unapologetically American belt buckle. Store.breitbart.com has these items and many more. So get your gear now at store.breitbart.com. This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to this incredibly exciting and fascinating and brilliant Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, brought to you by Breitbart, with my so exciting guests, Anne McElhenney and Felim McAleer, who are my old filmmaking friends who've just hit pay dirt with the most amazing story. Their book, their New York Times best-selling book, Gosnell, also a movie. The movie, I imagine, is it going to divide audiences? I mean, is it going to attract lots of conservatives, and liberals are going to boycott it because it makes them feel uncomfortable about abortion, or is that not going to happen?
It's certainly not our intention to have that. I mean, people who have seen the film, we play it very straight. Basically, everything that happens in it is something that actually happened in fact. And what we do is, quite a bit of the film is based on what happened in the courtroom. And we use, literally, the actual words from the courtroom. Because rewriting them wasn't a great idea, because you couldn't have made it more dramatic than what was actually said in the courtroom.
Have you got, like, filmed footage from inside the Chamber of Horrors?
Yes.
Stuff?
At the end of the film we actually show
photographs from the clinic. We show quite a lot of photographs at the end, because we felt it was very important that people would watch the film. And we can imagine liberals will, for example, say that never happened, and we thought, yeah, you know what, everything horrific that's in the film, we're going to show the actual photograph at the end, so that people will know that it really happened.
So we have the photographs of the baby's feet, we have the photographs of the cats that he had, you know, we actually have the photograph. We don't name the cats because they have privacy rights too, you know, and the cats are currently living in a witness protection program in Indiana. Actually, funny, somebody wrote to us the other day and says, what happened to cats? And you know what? We don't know what happened to cats. It's one of those unsolved mysteries.
Well, did the cats eat the...
No, the cats didn't eat the babies. He was reserved those for his lobster traps, his crab traps.
You're not serious.
I am. He had a beach house and in Jersey, and he was seen putting medical waste, as he called it, into the crab traps. And the cops actually went down with a diving team, but by the time they got down there, it was all been cleaned out.
The story just gets more and more extraordinary.
Yeah. No, it's desperate. And basically, the cops said that, you know, the crabs would have consumed everything, so that when they went down and tried to retrieve any of the remains, they found nothing. But they said that the children's tissue would have been very, very soft and would have been easily consumed completely by the crabs. So the other thing that he did, though, was because he had a dispute with the hazmat people who should have come and taken away the remains of the babies that he was murdering on the premises. And so when he had that dispute, they would put the baby's remains either down the toilet, was in one case, in quite a lot of cases, and also through the garbage disposal. So the garbage disposal, during the court case, the garbage disposal from the clinic was brought to court every day, and just to show the jury, this also had the remains of children in it.
And the janitor was asked, you know, the janitor kept quitting, and he says, "Why did you keep quitting?" He says, "Because the pipes kept getting blocked." And he was going, and he says, "What do you mean blocked?" He says, "You'd reach in and all this stuff would come out." And he says, "What do you mean stuff?" "Well, arms, legs."
And he said that under oath. I mean, you know, people, whether people like it or not, this is the kind of stuff. And I think this is the reason. I mean, you asked the question, why was it that the mainstream media didn't cover this trial? You know, if you did cover this trial, if you did properly cover this trial, it brings up some very awkward issues. So here's the thing, maybe that your listeners don't know, and I'm always anxious to tell people and educate people because I got a swift education. So you can have an abortion in America at 9 months. I did not know that. It's completely legal. Okay, James has got, just for the listeners who don't have the benefit of seeing this, he is looking completely shocked, I think he didn't know this.
No.
Right. So that's why I think it's important. So yes, you can have an abortion completely legally in the United States of America at 9 months. Completely legally. No special circumstances, none of that. You can just perfectly legally have an abortion at 9 months.
Not in every state?
No, but it doesn't really matter.
But
in
you can
five
just go
states.
To the right states.
Yeah,
the right
in about
state
five states,
state.
Including Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, California. You can have a nine... So I think a lot of people don't know that. And by the way, in more progressive states, like Pennsylvania, you can have an abortion perfectly legally at 24 weeks. That's 6 months. Now, James is a father. He was just explaining about his beautiful children. So, James, you know exactly what your wife looked like at 6 months pregnant.
I do.
That's major, right? And you got a baby moving around.
I'm astonished.
Yeah, but people don't know that. And you know what we think is really interesting, because we didn't know that. And we think that Planned Parenthood are geniuses, because basically they keep that. People don't know that. And when people do, they don't like it. Even pro-choice people don't like it. So this is the reason that this case was not covered. And also the reason it wasn't covered was because, as Phelan said, the good abortionists, inverted commas, the legal abortionists who took the stand and described good abortions, shocked, like really shocked, the people who sat there and listened to it. And so we have a lot of that testimony in the book, and I think it's the gift of this story that we get to hear the truth about abortion in America and, you know, let people decide.
Yes.
But at the moment, a lot of times, I think people don't know what's actually going on.
Because how long can a baby survive? When it comes out of the womb, it can survive at 6 months, can't it? Even?
Oh, absolutely. And there's plenty of cases of babies surviving 21 weeks, 22 weeks. So you can totally abort babies well after viability.
Human beings.
100%. And to mention that as well, we have seen the photographs that were presented by the ME. These are not pro-life pictures. The photographs of the children that were retrieved from the clinic, the 47 bodies. And I can tell you, their humanity is undeniable, the humanity in each one of them. They have expressions. There is one of the children who has his finger up. It is unbelievable. And these were not staged by pro-lifers. Let me just emphasize that. This is the ME who staged them for the jury. And he has no interest in one way or the other, you know, trying to influence people. He just needs to present the body so that the jury can can have a look at it clearly, and so that an expert witness can describe how viable the baby was, what age the baby was, etc.
I could talk to you about this book forever and this film. It just sounds extraordinary, and I can't wait to see it. But I wanted to, while I've got you both, I wanted to ask a bit about your... How you came to be this dynamic duo of kind of independent filmmaking, because it seems to me that you're quite a role model for people who just think, hey, I want to make movies. I'm just going to come out and do this shit. I mean, that's what you did, isn't it? You came out to America, both of you, and
yeah.
Why did you come to America first of all?
Well, we made movies that Americans seem to like, and also, you know, you're actually allowed to make movies that don't follow orthodoxy here. You're actually allowed to make them.
You said you make movies that Americans like. We know. that Hollywood is incredibly liberal biased. Yeah. So I imagine that you're both, how would you define your politics? Conservative-ish?
Ish.
What, libertarian?
Conservatarian-ish. No, actually, I'm a libertarian who doesn't like libertarians.
I hate libertarians as well. I'm a libertarian who hates libertarians.
Yes.
They're so sanctimonious.
And I'm going to say something about that. I remember going to an event with Andrew Breitbart. You know, Breitbart people will appreciate this. And I remember, with the event was full of libertarians. And I said to Andrew, I don't know what it is. I don't like libertarians, even though I like the idea of libertarians. And he basically said he hated libertarians. And it was just hilarious. So we had a little bonding about that.
What? Why did he hate libertarians? Did he?
I'm trying to think. I definitely don't want to misquote him, but I think there was a kind of a thing of that they weren't brave, basically. You know, that they wanted to be cool and wanted to be in with the in crowd, so that they, you know, so they were trying to water down their conservatism, basically.
Yeah. So you couldn't make a career in Hollywood, clearly, with your politics.
No, but we can make a career in America. You know, there's a lot more to America. No, it's we haven't. Breaking into the mainstream is obviously is challenging, right? But there's a thriving alternative media here, and we're making a living out of that. And we're
was Frank Nation your first?
No, we did Not Evil, Just Wrong.
Which Not Evil, Just Wrong. So
Mind Your Own Business.
And Mind Your Own Business before that.
Just briefly, what was Mind Your Own Business about?
It was about environmentalism versus developing communities. You know, so we looked at mining projects in Romania, Madagascar and Chile, and how locals wanted them but foreign environmentalists didn't.
So greenies were denying people in the third world the chance to have better lives.
Yes, yes, yes.
For their own good.
For their own good,
You should be living a life of backbreaking toil on the land.
Yes, because it's very romantic, you know, and it's beautiful.
Lovely.
And it's you know, as I say, you know, liberals look at a mud hut and see a culture, and locals look at a mud hut and see poverty, you know. It's like they confuse poverty with culture, you know. It's not, you know, poverty's a mistake for these people. So I think that's what really got us on the road. Was we found out, we went to a gold mine in Transylvania, and discovered that the environmentalists were lying, and the company were telling the truth, and the people wanted it, and the only people stopping it were two rich people, girls, women, ladies, other names I won't go into now, one from Switzerland, the other from Belgium, who were denying these people the chance to get ahead. And we just, you know, I remember the mining company says, yeah, the environment says, we're going to destroy the village. The mining company, yeah, we're going to destroy this village and we're going to build you a new one a mile away. And here's a model house we're going to show you. So we walked into the model house, and I remember walking in, and there was this 86-year-old woman in the middle of the living room crying. So we went over, oh, why are you crying? Isn't the mining company really evil? And she goes, I'm crying because I hope I live long enough to live in a house like this. Right.
Oh.
And she didn't live long enough to live in a house like this because the environmentalists won. And it was one of those things where we went up a hill one way. We're kind of typical liberal journalists, and we came down a different way. So it was very easy. It was one of those things where it's like, what side are you on? Are you on the side of this 86-year-old? Are you on the side of these two women who, when I've had a couple of pints of beer, I can tell you I have some choice words for those two. You know, women with too much time on their hands who've only ever enjoyed power showers and beautiful lives, but we're really happy to condemn these people to this shithole, by the way, up the side of a hill in Romania. And it was so easy, that, by the way. We came down and I was like, well, I know exactly what side I'm on now. And I am not happy with what these people are doing.
So before that film, had you been more ambivalent about it?
I'd say for before that, I didn't know much about environmentalists. But my thing about environmentalists was, like, when I was at university, I was very into beer and meeting young gentlemen and all of that. That was kind of my focus of my studies, let's just put it that way. But there were people who were called environmentalists around, you know, guys who had a lot of facial hair, who wore sandals and stuff like that. And I actually thought well of them. I thought very well of these women and men with the facial hair. I thought very well of them. I thought, you know, isn't it great now that somebody cares about stuff like that? I'm awful busy having my pints of beer, right? So, but I thought well of them. I thought I'm just too lazy to be involved. And I changed my tune on that.
Right.
These are not good people. These are people, exactly as you said, these are elitists who think it's okay for people to stay in poverty so that they can visit it and feel good about themselves. But they retreat back to their beautiful lives and their beautiful electricity and power showers and all the rest of the things that reliable energy bring, while you leave these people, you know, burning peat burning peat and trying to keep themselves warm in minus 20 degrees centigrade temperatures, you know. So it was very, very easy. So yeah, so I had a massive conversion experience on the side of a hill in Transylvania.
So the next film was Not Evil But Wrong.
Just Wrong.
But they are kind of evil as well, aren't they, really?
Yeah, that's what everyone... By the way, everyone said that to us after we came up with that title, but actually one of the people in the movie had used that phrase, so we just kind of thought it was good.
And that was... What was that about, briefly?
That was about climate change and basically, you know, the climate hysteria, the idea that, you know...
How it's going to affect... How climate hysteria is going to destroy the lives of the poorest people in America and on the planet, in the planet, you know? It's all very nice for rich people, climate change hysteria, but it's going to have real effects, pushing... electricity prices, stopping electricity development to billions of people who need it. So
it's one of the rarely mentioned aspects of climate change, isn't it? You look at all these left wingers who are pushing for environmentalism as a policy for wealth redistribution and so on to create social justice, and actually they are creating social injustice.
No, it's a crime if this stops electricity coming to the billions who need it. It's a crime almost. You know, it's sick actually. You know, I mean, if you love renewables that much, people like Michael Moore and all those people and Josh Fox, they should. The next time, you know, their mother is in hospital or their child is in hospital, they should insist that they're only treated in a hospital fueled by renewables, you know? So when they're on the operating table, they're looking at the skies to make sure the wind is still blowing or the sun is still shining. Because, you know, if it's good enough for the people of the third world or it's good enough for them, and, you know what? I bet you they wouldn't send their mother to a hospital fueled by renewables because it's unreliable, it's unsafe, and, you know, not much social justice there.
And then you... Fracknation.
Yes.
Was that your breakthrough film?
I think
Josh Fox, who's an environmental hero.
I think our timing was great with Fracknation because basically climate change was taken over by fracking as the greatest evil facing the planet was fracking. The truth is that fracking is the greatest miracle that ever happened. It's unbelievable. I'm actually I don't know if all your listeners know this, but I am just amazed. By the way, guys, I knew nothing about this stuff, and now I'm kind of this person who knows stuff about oil production. I find it just hysterical. So when they do this, here's what people should know. When they do this frack job, first of all, a frack job takes about 2 or 3 days, tops 3 days. And they do this thing, they put these pipes down, they push this water with sand and some chemicals at a huge pressure down, and then release it, and it creates these fissures in the shale rock. And what happens then is, this is the beauty of it, this is the bit I think is hysterical, how long does the gas come up? How long does the natural gas come up after that?
I'm guessing it's a matter of weeks, isn't it?
Stop. 10, 20, 30 years it comes up after this frack job. Oh yeah, it comes up for decades after that. Decades. Isn't that just hysterical? So I just thought that was amazing. So there is something really miraculous about it. Yeah, exactly. This is the kind of stuff that I think is amazing and people don't know. And so America has an enormous amount of this resource.
Enough for hundreds of years.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So this is a huge tragedy for environmentalists, because what was marvelous for environmentalists was we were running out of fossil fuels. They were like peak oil. Do you remember peak oil?
I do.
Peak oil was such a party for environmentalists because we were basically running out of fossil fuels. Well, we are not running out of fossil fuels. And natural gas has... I mean, and by the way, why they're not celebrating natural gas to me is beyond me. So America didn't sign up for Kyoto, but as a result of the substitution of natural gas of coal for natural gas or the other whatever, natural gas taking over from coal, CO2 emissions in the United States have gone way down, much, much more significantly than in a lot of these countries that have signed up for Kyoto. And no one's celebrating that. I mean, it's just hilarious. So the truth is they're just against fossil fuels in every form, no matter what.
You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my special guests Anne McElhenney and Felim McAleer. And we're broadcasting, if you hear the buzz in the background, this is broadcasting from the CPAC conference in Maryland, near Washington, D.C. More in a moment.
Breitbart News Daily with Alex Marlowe.
Paul in Connecticut, welcome to the show.
And I'm tired of banging my head against the wall, and every time you turn around, there's somebody else picking your pocket. It's insurance, it's taxes, it's regulations. I'm so sick of it. All they do is they hammer the people that want to get out there and do something every day, and they reward the people that stay home and do nothing. I'm beyond done with it. I've had it.
Breitbart News Daily, weekdays from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. East on SiriusXM Patriot 125.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole. Podcast is brought to you by Podcast One and Breitbart, and my guests this week, as you've already heard, are so amazing. They're Anne McElhenney and Phelan McAleer. We've been talking about their film Gosnell. We've been talking about their heroic career making independent movies from a kind of conservatarian perspective, talking about stuff like fracking and global warming and all sorts of interesting stuff. And Frack Nation, I love that film because I was in it, and I think it was a really sensible decision. I think I probably actually made the film what it was.
The Keystone.
Now, don't correct me if you think I'm wrong on that one. One of the many services you've done to the world, I think, is take on that outrageous claim by Josh Fox that fracking causes taps or faucets, are they called?
Yeah, faucets they call them in this part of the world. Yeah,
faucets that they cause blue flame to emerge. Now, how did Josh Fox feel about that when you confronted him with his lie?
As we used to say in the Carry On films, he doesn't like it up him.
You stood up at a press conference, didn't you, for his movie?
It was a Q&A, right? And it's, you can see it on YouTube, and it's a Q&A. But I think environmentalists don't really understand that Q&As involve me asking the Q's and him giving the A's, right? So I asked the Q, and he goes, "Who are you? Where are you from? What, you know?" I was like, "What's that?"
What was your Q?
My Q was, "You have this film. People setting their taps water on fire. Isn't it true that those people who could set their water on fire, that there was an official report saying worrying amount of methane in their water, and this report was from the 1970s, decades before fracking ever started, right? So you didn't tell the viewers that there was problems with methane in the water decades before fracking ever came to that area." And he would mumble. And then he says, "Yes, I know then there's been reports." I says, "But there's been reports of other places with methane in the water." He goes, "I know, there's been reports of people lighting their water on fire in North New York in the 1920s and 1930s. Yes, it was here, but I decided not to include it in the film because it's not relevant."
But yet that film, Gasland, has presumably been seen by many more people and won many more awards than Frack Nation.
Yes, and was nominated for an Oscar. And actually, the really sad bit is that it actually has had a very negative effect on fracking development, for example, in Ireland, where it's basically banned. I know in England that there's been a massive problem with them not
so
developing it.
So much problems.
Yeah. And this is something that would be so great for the United Kingdom. It would be great for Ireland. And it's really interesting, the place in Ireland where they could do it, Leitrim, is literally the most depressed county in the country. I mean, honestly, if any place could do it, this it would be incredible.
Whereas Ireland has gone really big for wind power.
Oh God, absolutely!
You're littered with.
Yeah, it's terrible, and in the most beautiful places.
Thankfully, the Irish economy is really robust and strong, and therefore they can afford to spend billions of euros on energy that doesn't really work and that no one can really rely on.
But Ireland is actually the place where they've had a class action suit brought by some families against a German wind manufacturer, and they've won a massive case. They're going to get a big payout for the damage done to their health and their peace by wind turbines. So it's not all bad. The tide is turning. So I wanted to ask you, Phelan, about a very bad experience, well, scary experience, but probably quite good journalism, good copy, on the Dakota Pipeline?
Yeah. So myself and Magda, our colleague, went up to the Dakota Access Pipeline, where those plucky environmentalists, friends of the earth, you know, water protectors, were stopping the evil pipeline and stopping the black snake and all that and the oil and evil and keep it in the ground. So I went up and, you know, they've got this massive camp there. And so I went around and I spent a day with them, and it was lovely. And the next day I went back and started saying to them, you know, I started asking some tough questions then. For example, you know, you how did you get here? We came in a car, I flew here, took a bus or whatever. I says, isn't it hypocritical that you used oil propelled vehicles to get here and you're protesting an oil pipeline? And in about 10 minutes, I was hit for the first time. They try to grab the microphone.
They physically hit you?
Yeah. Try to grab the microphone, drag me across the field. We went to our car to leave, and then suddenly we were surrounded by three cars, hemmed in, and they started banging the car and shaking the car. And we had, you know, I honestly feared for my life. And thought this was the end.
And you tried to use your mobile phone.
Mobile phone died, right? Because it's the middle of North bloody Dakota, right?
You hadn't got any battery.
No, wasn't died. It signal died. Then I got a new signal, phone 911. Rule 101 to all you young journalists out there, by the way, I just want to give you one little piece of advice. If you're going somewhere, find out where you're going. Because the cop says, "Where are you?" And I go, in the middle of a field in North Dakota. And they go, "Where?" And I was going, the protest camp. Which one? I don't know. Just the protest camp. So they went to the wrong protest camp. It was, you know, so eventually a pile of cops arrived. And the protesters kept saying, even if the cops arrive, they won't come down here. This is a no-go zone for them, right? They haven't been, and they hadn't been in the field yet, you know, because there's 10,000 nut jobs there, right? So eventually what happened was we could see the cops going past with their sirens to rescue us, but they were going to a different protest field, right? So we started blowing the horn, right? And some cops saw it, and then they all realized it was us. So next thing, all the cop cars, but they pulled up on the road outside. There was 6 to 8 cop cars out there, but they wouldn't come into the field. And they started broadcasting through a microphone or a loudspeaker, release those people, right? And they wouldn't come down. Now, afterwards, they said they would have come down, but there was only 15 of them, and there was a couple of hundred protesters to rescue us.
And who were the protesters?
I mean, funny, they were... I've been in a lot of these events. These were deep criminals. You know, this had a special flavor to it. A lot of criminals, a lot of thugs, a lot of people. I mean... I suppose there was a lawlessness to it that I hadn't seen at many of these protests before. A complete anarchy.
Okay, so they're criminals. So what are they doing when they're not on protest camps?
Good question. You know, maybe they're these. You know, they probably are professional protesters. A lot of Native Americans as well. Young Native Americans. There was a definite, you know, who seemed to have a lot of anger towards the state,
Is that a scene? Is there quite a phenomenon of Native Americans sort of joining the kind of victimhood bandwagon?
I think that's what one of the things was. Yeah, it was a lot of Native Americans who have been brought up on this thing that the white man is to blame for everything, and this pipeline has really allowed them to focus that. Right. And we were there, and we were part of that, and they were just going to really make us into mincemeat. And there was people in masks, bandanas. They had dogs. They had sticks. They started shaking the car. It was a while. I thought our chips were up. You know.
Did you? And what thoughts were going through your head at that point?
How can we save the footage was one of them, you know. because if I was going to die for my story, I'll tell you, I was going to make sure that the footage was saved. The scariest part of it was that there was two other people in the car, and they were looking to me for decisions, right? I was the leader, and I was like, what are you looking at me for? I don't know. I mean, because I was literally sitting in this car, right, and I could see a path. Where there were two cars in front of us and one right up behind us, so we couldn't reverse. And I saw that if we cut down the hill and cut round over, there was this steep bank and a fence at the top, and there the road was beyond that. And I'm thinking, in the movies this works.
In the movies it would have worked.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, does this work? So what happens if we go up the hill and we start sliding? What happens if we go up the hill and try to curse through the fence and get stuck there? I don't know. Do SUVs go through fences like they do in the movies? You know, it was a wire fence too. So I was thinking, if you go through the wire, all these thoughts were going through my head. And I was thinking, once I do that, that's the nuclear option. At the moment, I'm alive, right? And they haven't tried to break into the car, but that was the next thing. So I'm sitting there, what do I do? Like, and everyone's looking at me saying, what do I do? And I don't know. So you have to make a decision whether you go for the nuclear option. And reality is, they were standing in front of the car, and every time we tried to edge forward, more of them would gather. So we're going to have to run over one of them, right? And that's a big nuclear option as well.
But did you at any point think, I won't do this again. I won't be a troublemaker and a loudmouth and a shit stirrer.
No. No, that never occurred. No. Actually, well, I think what I'll do next time is Saint Anne.
Yeah, very. They would never touch a woman, would they? Would they?
Yeah, because they're progressive like that. Yeah.
Well, Felian McAleer and McElhenney, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We could have gone on for hours. And actually, I think you're going to have to come back on another podcast a few more films down the line.
Yeah.
And tell me what it's like. Are you going to be incredibly rich now that you've had this triumph?
Now that
we're New York Times best-selling authors, we certainly hope to do that. And your listeners can help by buying the book at gosnellbook.com and supporting the movie at gosnellmovie.com. We make it very simple for people to find us on the World Wide Web.
Actually, maybe people in England, I know this is an international podcast, people in England can download the book, ebook, or an Audible. I'm not sure that Amazon is selling it over there or whatever, but there's ways of getting it.
Can I say, I can see why you're very successful, because you're very good hucksters. You're very good at selling your produce.
We took to this capitalism thing very well, actually.
Well, ever since the English, ever since James's people came over and took our land about 500 years ago, we've had to learn.
So basically, what you're saying is I'm responsible. My people are responsible for your success. So on that note, thank you very much. You're listening to James Dellingpole on the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole. Thank you, my lovely friend, and goodbye.